me this morning was what a wonderful Zendo this is. I had never been in here before. And it really fosters a deep silence in looking inward. So I felt really there was some very strong and deep practice going on this morning. And I just wanted to continue it. I felt like talking would just interrupt the silence. And maybe we learn more from our own silence than from anyone talking. But then I also had this thought that Suzuki Roshi expressed the same thought at one point and said, after doing Zazen, I don't want to talk. I want to just continue to be silent. But being ready means to go on to the next thing and to do what comes next. We cannot spend our life sitting silently. We have a time to sit silently, and then that time is over, and then comes the next thing. And we're ready for the next thing. So now is the time for talking. And what I want to talk about today is home. What is home? What or where is home for us? For many of us, when we first set foot in the Zendo, in a Zendo, we feel like we've come home. That was certainly my own experience. When I first came to Kanando, first time I stepped inside, I had the strong feeling, yes, this is it. This is where I want to be. This is my home. I couldn't have told you where that came from or what it was about, but the feeling was definitely there and it was strong. So, what home is, we know it intuitively. And it can be a dramatic experience or subtle. It's different for different people. And looking back after a while, we think, well, why haven't I known this earlier? What took me so long to find this? But the fact is, we did know it earlier. The knowledge is just covered over. I knew in my teens that I wanted to be a monk. But I expected absolutely no support for that idea. So I didn't even say it out loud, because if I had, I think my family would have questioned my sanity. They would have had no understanding. And to this day, don't have any, but that's up to them, whether they want to understand or not. So, I took a different path, a more conventional path, and sort of this original intuition of what I wanted to be and do with my life got kind of covered over and, you know, pushed to the background and eventually forgotten. So So we may have an inkling early in life what we want to do with our life. But maybe prevailing values or structures in society may prevent us from following that path. And we are, when we're young, we are encouraged to do something more useful or practical. People are going to say, well, how are you going to make a living being a monk? And that is certainly a practical consideration, but it takes us away from our original intuition of what we wanted to do. And then we embark on our life. We achieve this and that, and we go to school, and we get a degree, and we find a job, and we may find a partner, and get married, and have children, and so it goes. And sometimes it seems our life gets pushed along by circumstances that we have created ourselves, or that happened. Unforeseen events happen. Somebody gets sick and we get diverted from the path that we had mapped out for ourselves in order to take care of someone. So such events happen and we don't necessarily have control. Until the day comes that we say, who am I in all of this? Who is this person doing all these things and playing all these roles in this life? And am I living my life the way I really want to live? Or am I just reacting and responding to circumstances as they arise? And that may be the beginning of a spiritual practice, spiritual path. A search for our true home. A search for our original self that may have gotten buried under all the things we need to do, all the obligations that we've taken on. A search for the self that we've always been and that we want to come back to. So in the Genjo Koan, Dogen says, when we first seek the Dharma, we stray far from the boundary of the Dharma. When the Dharma is correctly transmitted, one is immediately one's original self. So when we first start practice, it is often to solve a problem or to redirect our life in some way, because it has become unsatisfactory or maybe downright unbearable. We have searched for happiness and maybe we found it in some measure. Maybe we've become successful professionally, or we've made some money. But as time goes on, we see that those things do not really provide lasting happiness. There's always something missing. And then by then we have gotten older and maybe we've lost someone who was close to us. And we can really see, we begin to understand the first noble truth, that life is suffering. So we turn to spiritual practice in the hope that it will provide us with answers, and that we may find some peace and contentment. In other words, we begin spiritual practice with a goal in mind. We want something. So, whereas we have been pursuing accomplishments and worldly goods, we may now seek peace and enlightenment and relief from suffering that we think may come with spiritual practice. And we pursue spiritual practice with the same grasping mind that we used to pursue worldly goods before. So, at the beginning, some of that goal orientation is necessary. Otherwise, we may not ever start practice. If we didn't have a desire to change our life in some way, to make it more bearable or make it happier, we would probably never even start. So it is okay to seek something at the beginning. If we knew from the very beginning that Zazen was good for nothing, we wouldn't ever even start. Why would you do that if there's nothing in it for you? So Dogen says, when one first seeks the Dharma, one strays far from the boundary of the Dharma. We stray from the Dharma because we think there's something to get. It is this grasping mind, the wanting mind, that makes us miss the point. The Dharma is not another means to achieve a goal or to satisfy our searching mind. But Dogen goes on to say, when the Dharma is correctly transmitted, one is immediately one's original self. When we finally come to see, often after many years of practice, that this grasping, wanting mind is really the biggest obstacle to realizing the Buddha way, we have to let go of all ideas about what Zazen can do for us. We have to let go of attaining enlightenment or becoming a Buddha or achieving any other goal that we've set for ourselves. So a good illustration of that point is the story that you probably all know of Matsu and the polishing of the tile. Matsu, in his later life, became a very famous Zen master, one of the most famous in China. And when he was young and started, when he was young in practice, he studied with Nan Yue, who had a very large monastery, probably 1,000 students. And with that many students, you can't know everybody. And the teacher, Nan Yue, did not know Matsu, and Matsu was very determined about sitting zazen. He said whenever he had a free minute, he would go into the zendo and sit. And so one of the senior students of Nan Yue pointed this student out to the teacher. And one day, Nan Yue went into the zendo, and there was Matsu sitting by himself. And Nan Yue asked him, "Why do you sit zazen so much?" And Matsu answered, "I want to become a Buddha." Whereupon the teacher took a tile that had fallen off the roof and started polishing. And Matsu was a little startled and said, "Master, why are you doing that?" "Well, I want to make this tile into a mirror," the teacher said. Well, Matsu very logically said, "Well, how can a roof tile become a mirror?" So the teacher said, "How can you become a Buddha by sitting zazen? Can't be done." So Matsu was practicing zazen in hopes to become a Buddha. He had a goal in mind that he wanted to accomplish, and zazen was the means to get there. And his teacher relieved him of this idea. Zazen is not a means to an end. So just sit as the Buddha you are, and don't strive to become something else. The roof tile is perfect as a roof tile. It doesn't need to be a mirror. Our true nature is perfect as it is. All we need to do is allow it to come forward and to enrich and heal and enlighten the world. And that is where our home is. To be ourselves, our very own authentic, original selves. The self that arises from our deepest heart. The self that is the unique manifestation of Buddha nature. The self that is completely empty and at the same time full of possibility and connection. So the first of our precepts says, "I take refuge in Buddha." What does that mean, to take refuge in Buddha? We take refuge in our original self. Without any idea of who or what we are. and without any idea of attaining something. We accept ourselves as the Buddha that we are. And we allow that self to come forward and be seen in the world. And when we do that, we're home, wherever we are, or whatever our circumstances are. Anybody want to ask a question?
So Dogen said, as soon as you seek the Dharma, you stray far from the boundary of the Dharma. Does the Dharma have a boundary?
Maybe the Dharma doesn't have a boundary, but you're seeking. What are you seeking? The difficulty is in the seeking, not in whether the Dharma has a boundary or not.
You know, when people start the process of coming to be with themselves, really does somebody sit down and face the wall and say, I've arrived, I'm here? Usually it's like, what's this about? Who am I? What's to figure it out? And it seems like the seek part starts to open up a lot of doorways that maybe initially, you know, your motivation isn't deep or vast, but yet that inkling, that seeking, that there's even though it's not the way to go, it's not an arrow that's going to hit a mark, it is actually gets you on your horse to go.
Yeah, initially we have to have that motivation, that idea that we can get somewhere. Can get something. Maybe sitting zazen is going to help us get somewhere. But over time, you let go of that idea. Mm-hmm. Because this idea that I need to get somewhere, that is what's making you stray from the Dharma. Yes? No?
Yeah, I mean, we're here.
comes to mind my experience more than notion or idea. And my experience was with the breath by a therapist, because I was in fear, really, I think, and it was in my breath. So she said, try this. And it calmed me down. That was not an idea, it was something that was suggested. I try physically So I suppose if I seek something, it's would be calmness, I suppose, but I also am aware that by seeking it, it doesn't mean that that's going to happen. So I just experience, really, rather than idea. So I...
Well, what underlies the fear, though?
Pardon me?
What underlies the fear?
Well, yeah. That's why I'm here.
Are there ideas underneath the fear?
Oh, yeah. There are ideas. There are feelings. There's many things.
Yeah.
But I don't think I was clearer about those ideas, because that was under the effect of the ideas I couldn't see. So,
well, you know, we subsume a lot of things under the term idea.
Mm-hmm.
That you say it was an experience rather than an idea is not a contradiction. You know, even an experience can be based on an idea. So if you dig deep enough, you will get to the idea that underlies the fear. Is based on ideas of what could happen, what might happen, what you're afraid of. Yes,
I don't have any question. I felt everything you said, and I really thought it was very tender and gentle, although nothing new. But thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I have a question. I have a few comments.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I feel, and other people here may feel, is I get a sense of what you're saying, and there's different ways of speaking about things. There's a different angle
mm-hmm.
to approach it, and I sense in my heart what you're saying is true. You're coming at it from a certain angle, describing it. I'm going to look at it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I wasn't looking at that and I was just taking it face value, I'd say, oh, you're completely wrong. I completely disagree with you, because I have a different angle that I and other people here do as well that I look at, which is that, I don't know who said it, Koban probably repeated it, but 1 minute of sitting, 1 minute of being a Buddha. That's a very famous sensei. My own experience as a teenager, sitting down, being introduced to Zazen, something I was really wanting to know, really, wow, because I've been a little bit introduced to it, but I wanted to know more, and putting 100% effort into it, I got immediate results. You know, it's all, my experience has been the same as what I have, some great masters have written, and I was lucky enough to read some of this stuff. It's, you get back proportionate to what you put into it. So if you're putting in 100% into it, you're really going to get the results back. The one thing that you're talking about, I think this is what you're talking about, which is true, which is you can't go into this thing thinking, I'm going to be enlightened, because your ego, to be enlightened, it means dissolving and fading away of the ego, nirvana, and extinction of the ego, going out. That's the big contradiction. That's the truth, the big truth there. However, the closer we come to as we progress along, and we have this understanding, an intuitive understanding in our heart, we're getting these results, there's no problem, there's no contradiction. With some people who I have known, they ended up having a big problem with ego. It ended up being their downfall in a really bad way, because they didn't remember the necessity of, you know, look towards taking care of other, helping other people, be humble,
They weren't following that. They were more this ego thing, and it caused the downfall. But that's my angle, and I think you're actually saying the same thing, but you're saying it in a different way.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't feel that we are contradicting each other. Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. Back to Dogen's quote.
Mm-hmm.
Our call, the phrase is when the Dharma is perfectly transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
So, who or what is the agency of transmission? Is there a what or a who, or is it an outside agency, an agent, or is that? Because
it's no, it's not an outside agency. It's your own recognition of what the Dharma is, what Buddha is, what you are yourself. Insight into who you are. It's not, I mean, outside agency, you can talk about it with a teacher, but the teacher cannot tell you, cannot transmit. There's nothing to transmit. You have to realize it yourself.
So the role of the teacher is?
Maybe to point you in the right direction, or to say, well, I'll try this. But the teacher cannot actually tell you where you're going. This is up to you to figure out.
So there's the famous, I don't know all the details of this, maybe you could sort of straighten it out for me. There's the rice and the painting of the rice cake.
Mm-hmm.
So a thought or a feeling could be merely the painting of the rice cake. You eat the rice and you remember, oh, what a wonderful rice I had. You might remember that for years. So in trying to discern the experience from the thought or the feeling, that seems to be a bit of the challenge.
The story says, looking at a painting of a rice cake does not satisfy hunger.
Well, that was the dialogue?
Yeah.
Who was this?
You know, I don't know the details of the story off the top of my head. But you look at a picture of a rice cake and it might cause you to have an idea of what a rice cake is and how good it would taste if you actually ate it. But insight comes only by eating it. It doesn't necessarily come with looking at a picture of it.
So the same applies to the story of Matsu.
Yeah.
Is that the correlation then? He's sitting. Why are you sitting?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know if that's the same story. You know, I don't think so. Matsu was hoping to gain something by zazen, by sitting zazen. If you look at a painting of a rice cake, are you hoping that your hunger will be satisfied? No, you know that it will not be.
I can make you even more hungry.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So,
I was visiting with a friend of mine, stayed at a place during my voyages at different times. We had been in a group together for quite some time. She's a very brilliant woman, but she has this idiosyncrasy, you know, kind of, she's not good at organizing things. She just has trouble. And she was made a Tenzo. And first Tenzo assistant, and then 2 years, Tenzo assistant for a year, and then Tenzo assistant for 2 years. And her hopes were that by the end of that, and all the pressure, you know, she would, some of it would rub off into her daily life, and she'd become a more organized person. And at other times, I've heard her express, Zen training is very good.
It's very good.
It's very good for me for this.
Oh, okay.
Even though she knows full well that's not really what it's about, she's always sort of hoping, you know. Well, at the end of this period, and her husband was here, and he attested that no, it didn't do her any good. In terms of organizing, you know, she was the same. And I said, yeah, that's the way I found her. And I can be really, like, meticulous in the Zendo. And, you know, during the session, and in my daily life, for a short time, you're going to my old habits just. And, it, you know, on the one hand, you tell this story, and I say, I get it, you know, and I was telling her, yeah, you can, but on the other hand, when we talk about moral families, and this comes up quite often, I hear, I've heard it in this group, we would like to think that what we're doing makes us more compassionate and kinder, that somehow, you know, that, I mean, that's a sense of Buddha, that this practice does some good for alleviating suffering. We say this is what we're doing, it's our intention, and if the Zazen doesn't help with that, is it just the Zazen that they're pointing at, or, you know, or the practice in its entirety that knows the
You know, it opens up a big discussion about what makes us compassionate. It's also, you can see it as a goal to say, oh, I want to sit silent because I want to become a more compassionate person. And maybe to a little extent that is true. It will make you more compassionate. But there is this sense of I should be compassionate because I'm practicing, or they say I'm a Buddha and therefore I should be more compassionate, but that's not where true compassion comes from. True compassion comes more from knowing in your bones that you are not separate from somebody else. That you are carrying somebody else's suffering. And therefore, you want to help. You want to take their suffering upon yourself. Because you're not separate. Not a moral imperative. You should be compassionate. That doesn't work. Or not very well, anyway. And, you know, whether you're organized or not, whether your practice helps you to be organized, it's a practical question. Do you need to be organized? Why? Who says you need to be organized? You can be disorganized, you know? I don't care. You can be a wonderful practitioner and have deep insight and be disorganized. It's okay. There is some expectation on the part of society that you should be organized. Fine, but you don't have to follow it.
Yeah.
Wait.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes? No?
You said wait.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure what was going on there. I can't see everyone's face.
I wasn't sure he was done.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. The practice ultimately will result in a greater understanding of this unity or this non-separation. So consequently, it should result in greater compassion. Not because of a moral imperative, but because you're doing the practice. And Mike said something a few weeks ago, in a session in response to someone's question about gurus, and he said that a practice that doesn't result in greater loving kindness and compassion is an authentic practice. And I happen to have read something like that from somebody else just like the week before. And something that I've seen quite a bit in Zen is this, is like the Buddha's original teachings, the way I understand it, are greater than talking about sitting. There, he prescribes a whole way of living a life with starting with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And it's a really wonderful way to be with other people in community and in society. And so I feel like we never talk about that. Literally, I've never heard anyone in the last year talk about the Eightfold Path. I know we do talk about it. For me, it's the aspect of greater compassion and loving kindness, not as a moral imperative, but as a natural outcome of the practice, is sort of my divining rod whether I really want to keep doing this or not.
If you do your practice sincerely and in a devoted way, you will probably gain greater understanding and be more compassionate. But I wouldn't take it as a guaranteed outcome that it is that way for everybody. If I do practice, if I sit every day, then I will become this or that. There's no guarantee that you will. You need to practice very sincerely with an open heart. Otherwise, it may not happen. When you say 1 minute of sitting is 1 minute of being Buddha, if you sit in a sincere way, not all sitting. All sittings are alike, you know. Sometimes the sitting is not very focused or concentrated, or we don't let go of all thoughts, you know. We think the whole time about something or other. That's not really the kind of sitting that allows you to know that you're Buddha. So when I say you need to sit sincerely, you need to let go of your thoughts. You need to sit like Buddha. Then that is true, that 1 minute of sitting is 1 minute of Buddha. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I'll also make this comment. It's not strictly about Zazen, but I took a compassion training at the Stanford course.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like, it's different. A directed meditation with a goal in mind is different than Zazen for sure. So I guess I'll just.
Yeah, I would say it is.
Yeah, okay. So I think, in other words, it's possible to cultivate compassion, but not that wouldn't be an aspect of this practice that we're...
Okay.
Thank you.
There may be other ways to cultivate compassion, but this is the way through practice.
Okay.